Dr. Coleman's Store, Tuesday, December 15. I am not the only woman who has come to Coleman's in hope of finding something today. There are two women at the counter waiting to be served, and three more at the back when I step in, wicker basket tucked in the crook of one arm. I pause just inside the doorway to shrug out of my riding cloak and shake the snow from my hair. The stack of pelts beside the counter hasn't grown any taller, but I don't like the bright, bushy red tail sticking out from the center. I'm scowling when I turn and come face to face with Sarah White. The young woman takes one look at my expression, bursts into tears, and tries to push her way past. "Wait," I say, dropping my basket with a thump. I grab Sarah's arm. "What's wrong?" "I should have known better. Come early or late," Mother said, "but not while the ladies are out." Ladies, a pejorative if I've ever heard one. I lead her to the side. "Tell me what happened." "Them," Sarah says, nodding to where three women huddle in the far corner, backs to the room. "Made it clear I wasn't welcome here." "It isn't their store." She sniffs and wipes two fat tears off each cheek with a cuff of her sleeve. "They sure act like it is." If Sarah White had been born in another town, to different parents, she would have married early and well. Her face alone would have assured that, but her figure would have likely caused a duel. As it stands, she lives in the Hook, and her parents were ill-equipped to protect such a lovely girl. A dalliance with a member of the Boston militia last year has left her with a bastard daughter and a ruined reputation. "Did you find what you need?" I ask. She shakes her head. "Well, you'd best do it then. It isn't often you get out without the baby, and your mother won't like to see you come home empty-handed." "But let them answer to me," I say, nudging Sarah back into the shop. I grab my basket and move to the back where Coleman keeps the sewing supplies. The three women sift through bolts of fabric spread along a table. They whisper amongst themselves, laughing, and I listen as one of them speaks in a tone bubbling with glee. "Can you believe how brazen Sarah is, flouncing around without that baby?" I look through the slats in the shelf to find Clarissa Stone running her hand along a bolt of soft blue cotton. Her face is angled toward the companion on her right, mouth twisted into a vicious smile. "It's indecent," Rachel Blossom agrees. Peggy Bridge chimes in then, unable to resist a bit of gossip and a disapproving tisk. "There are hours for her to shop. Her mother should have taught her." "Oh, her mother clearly didn't teach her anything," Clarissa says. And I am opening my mouth to excoriate them all when she adds, "Did you hear about Sam Dolwyn?" I step back to make sure they don't see me. "What about him?" "He and May were married in Henry Sewell's living room on Sunday. They went to housekeeping immediately. Her mother is furious." Clarissa receives exactly the response she intended. Mmms and tisks and heads that shake in judgment. "Doesn't it seem odd?" she asks. "They only posted their notice of intent 6 weeks ago." Peggy, not one to be left out, adds, "I heard they made quite a public show of affection. My husband saw Sam kiss May right on the street." This last word is said with such an air of scandal that she may as well have implied they ran naked through town after church. Clarissa nods, pronouncing her verdict with certainty. "May is pregnant." The others gasp, but it's only for show, and she looks gratified when she adds, "Why else would they marry so quickly?" It is an appalling display of hypocrisy, and I will not tolerate it a moment longer. I step out from behind the shelf, startling them. They spin around, horrified to find that their ugly conversation has been overheard, and by me no less. Varying expressions of shame, anger, and suspicion dart across their faces. Both Clarissa and Peggy are heavily pregnant. Clarissa to such a degree that it looks as though she might already be past due. I let my gaze linger over their swollen bellies, let them grow uncomfortable beneath my gaze. Perhaps they married quickly because they are in love. Or because Sam nearly died a couple of weeks ago, and that certainly makes a man think there is no time to waste. I move closer, lower my voice. There is nothing wrong with a man wanting to share a bed with his wife right from the start. What is wrong, however, is gossiping about your neighbors in such a cruel way. And not just Sam Dalwyn, a good man by anyone's standards, but Sarah White. That is rich, even for the likes of you three. As I recall, I add, twisting the knife, you delivered your first child 4 months after your wedding, Peggy. It was 6 months for you, Rachel. I look to Clarissa Stone and shake my head. But you're the one who should be most ashamed of your pious outrage. It took a year and a bitter paternity suit before Paul would make an honest woman out of you. I don't have to remind them how I know this, how I attended each of them in childbirth, and that, in Clarissa's case, I received testimony as to the paternity of her child, which I later gave in court when she sued for maintenance. Not one of you has the right to speak, I say, and if you had a lick of integrity, you would go apologize to Sarah this instant. Only Rachel Blossom has the decency to blush. The others shift and glare before turning their noses to the ceiling and brushing past me. I am sorry, Rachel whispers as she turns her face to the floor and follows after them. But like her friends, she does not say a word to Sarah on her way out. I watch them go, imagining how they must be cursing me under their breath as they hustle back to their homes. They have left the bolts of fabric in disarray, so I fold and straighten them into neat rows on the table. A bolt of pale green silk catches my attention, and I pluck it from the pile, run my thumb along the nubby weave, check the price tag, put it back, pick it up again, back and forth 5 times, until I make up my mind and tuck it under one arm. I do need a new dress, after all. I look up to find Sarah White standing in front of me. Thank you, she says. You didn't have to defend me. I made my choices, but I'm glad you did nonetheless. It was the truth, and they needed to hear it. Sarah looks so sad as she's turning away that I reach for her hand. I want to ease her embarrassment, to reassure her that not everyone in the Hook considers her an outcast. Their opinion of you doesn't matter, Sarah. It isn't just them, Martha. It's everyone. It's hard to stare down an entire town, she says, then goes to pay for the items in her basket. I watch as Sarah leaves, her chin tucked against the collar of her dress to avoid the cold blast of wind. It pains me to think of her so alone and ostracized in this community. It will be harder for her to find a husband now that she's already born a child. But she is not without hope, and I resolve to help find her a man who will love her as she is. I turn back to the sewing supplies and ask, where are the needles? Behind you and to the left, second shelf from the bottom, green jar, Holman calls out from the front of the store. You heard that? I'm mostly blind, Mistress Ballard, but me ears work fine. Sure enough, the needles are right where he said, and I take a packet from the jar, then sort through another beside it for buttons, before bringing everything to the front. I set the basket at my feet and lean against the counter. I'm afraid to ask just how well your ears were working a few moments ago. You weren't taking great pains to keep your voice down, and they deserved it regardless. Perhaps, but it wasn't very kind of me. And what they were accusing Sam Dalwyn of, that was kind, he asks. Hardly, although it is human nature, I suppose. Hypocrisy? Well, yes, they feel better about themselves whenever anyone else is caught doing the same. But neither Sam nor May have been caught in anything, which is why I didn't hold my tongue. And I like you all the better for it, he says. Coleman turns back to his chessboard. Now, how can I help you this morning? I slide the packet of needles across the counter, along with a small pile of buttons and the silk. Will that be all? There are a dozen things that I would like to have. A new cast-iron kettle for the kitchen, a set of blue glass bottles for my workroom. But as I do each time I step through these doors, I remind myself of what I need. Nothing, unless you've heard where they took James Wall. I hear he's been confined to the jail yard at Fort Western until his debt has been paid. So he posted bond then? Coleman nods. Yesterday. Being confined to the jail yard and being in jail are two entirely different things. The latter is, as it sounds, arrest and confinement for a set period of time. The former, however, is a loose arrangement in which those waiting trial, or those who have been arrested for unpaid debts, are able to post bail and then go about their work during the day, within a set area, but must return to the jailhouse by dark. Sunrise to sunset. The bounds of their freedom include a distance of 1 mile on either side of the river, from Mill Brook to the bend in Water Street. In the rare instance when a home or business falls outside of that boundary, it is included as well. Coleman studies me for a moment, and I get the feeling he's deciding whether or not to tell me something else. There's a bit of food stuck between his teeth, and he picks at it with his tongue for a moment, then says, "That new doctor of yours has created quite a stir." "He's not mine," I protest. "Most folks seem to be glad he's here. Having another real doctor is a boon to this town, they say, and he's got money." At this he offers a crooked grin. "So, I don't hate him." "Money?" "Oh, aye. His young wife arrived on Friday, bought up half the store so she can set up house." He gives me a knowing look. "She is very pregnant. Only a few months left, I'd say."
"They're renting rooms?"
"No," he shakes his head. "A house across the river. They've leased the old McMaster place right near the Chandlery."
"Well, that explains a lot," I mutter.
"Be careful with him, Martha. He's made it plain that he doesn't care for you, thinks you're a meddler."
The feeling is mutual.
"Perhaps, but he's recruiting to his side, and that will hurt you in the end. What with the Burgess fiasco and Grace Sewell's delivery."
"You know about that?"
"He's made sure that everyone knows. Says that you insisted he give that girl a near lethal dose of laudanum. Adamantly opposed he was. But he deferred given that you know the girl. Wanted to make nice with the local midwife after the dust-up in court. Him being a genial fellow and all."
"That foul little bastard, I did no such—"
Coleman sets his hand on mine. "I know, but that's what you're dealing with, and you ought to be aware." I groan and rest my elbows on the counter, drop my head to my hands. Damn that Burgess. If he wasn't already dead, I'd kill him myself for all the trouble he's caused. As I hear it, he's still causing trouble. When I look up, he's trying to wrestle a grin into submission. Barnabas Lambert? Got quite a fright, he did, when Amos pulled back that tarp, demanded to know what happened. So Amos told him everything. And then that officer marched right to Henry Sewell's office and looked at the court records. From what I hear, he seems to agree with your assessment. I am beginning to like that boy. Well, he don't like you overmuch right now. He doesn't have to like me as long as he keeps asking the right questions. You might regret saying that one day, Coleman laughs. That boy don't seem the sort to stop.
I place everything into my basket and hoist it over my arm. Thank you for the goods and gossip.
Always, he says, and once more reaches out his old weathered hand and grabs mine. Be careful, Martha. Sentiment has turned against Rebecca Foster. It's turning against you as well.
Ballard's Mill, Thursday, December 17. Thursday, December 17. Birth. Mr. Stone's daughter.
Clarissa Stone was delivered of a dead daughter at the 12th hour yesterday, the operation performed by Dr. Benjamin Page. The infant's limbs were much dislocated, as I am informed. The man knows not how to deliver a breech presentation. Hannah brought the news this afternoon. One day after scolding Clarissa Stone at Coleman's store, she went into labor. And instead of calling for me, as she should have, she called for Dr. Page. This is my fault. I'm certain of it. I know I was hard on her for shunning Sarah and gossiping about Sam, but this, it is too high a price to pay for her and for me. I set my pen down, close my eyes, weep. Ballard's Mill, Friday, December 18. Ephraim is dead. That is the nagging fear that has plagued me over the last 12 days, and I have to drive it from my mind so it does not take root and fester. I feel his absence as though it were a missing limb, some vital part of me gone, and often find myself looking to the lane watching for his return. I must leave for Vassalboro on Tuesday, with or without him. I would prefer with, of course, but am growing less certain by the hour that he will make it home in time. If he makes it home at all. No, I say aloud, taking that thought captive as well. In his absence, I keep myself busy. Cooking, cleaning, spinning flax and weaving linen. I tend to the neighbors and my patients when they call, making tinctures and syrups in my workroom. I manage our small farm and assign work for my children. Cyrus runs the mill. Hannah and Dolly milk the cows. Jonathan tends the livestock. Young Ephraim oversees the chickens and tends to the horses. He has a soft voice and gentle hands, and I have never seen a horse startle or rear in his presence. Still, he's a bit young for the job, and I check on Brutus and Bucket once a day just to make sure all is well. I slide between the heavy barn doors, a bucket of slops in each hand. It is time to feed the pigs, but Jonathan is nowhere to be found, which means he slipped off again without telling anyone. The barn was built as a large square with a peaked roof and four separate quadrants on the inside, one each for the horses, cattle, goats, and pigs, with a cross-shaped walkway between the pens. It smells of old straw and fresh manure, of alfalfa, hay, and barley stacked in the upper loft. It smells of warm animals and wet sawdust. The horses whicker as I make my way between the stalls. Both dairy cows are pregnant, and they shift and low at the sound of my voice, while the bull stomps and snorts in his pen. He is restless, eager for another chance at the cows, but he's done his job for the year and will have to wait until breeding season in June. The calves, one male and one female, are bored and they nap, oblivious, as the goats bustle in their pen, bleating out their request for dinner. Hush, I say, it's not your turn. Jonathan will see to you later. I lift one bucket and then the other over the pig pen rail, and dump the contents into the trough, wincing at the wet, vomitous sound. I don't stay to watch the fat, pink animals root and snort their way through dinner. I have never been fond of messy eaters. I am almost at the barn door when I hear the thing I've spent weeks listening for, the heavy clop of horse hooves on frozen ground. Ephraim, I whisper, and run out the door, an empty bucket swinging from each hand. They bounce against my calves as I hurry down the path, careful not to slip on the hard-packed snow. My smile evaporates the moment I round the bend and reach the front yard. Joseph North has dismounted his bay mare and is tying his reins to the gatepost. His mongrel dog sits at his feet, looking at me as though I were a meal. He bares his teeth but doesn't growl. I drop the wooden buckets with a clatter and set my hands on my hips. What do you want?
I've come to see the results of Ephraim's survey. I stopped by the mill, but he wasn't in.
He may as well have said that he stopped by for tea or to bring payment on a late bill, but his eyes are pinched at the corners, calculating, and I know that he came to see if Ephraim has returned. That's because he isn't at the mill.
Where is he then?
Out.
Where?
I have never met a man who enjoys giving his wife an account of his every movement, Colonel. Ephraim goes where he pleases and returns when he will. As to the where and when, you'll have to ask him yourself, because I certainly don't know. North takes in my disheveled appearance, the tatty work clothes, dirty hands, and the scarf tied around my hair.
I see that I have caught you in the middle of your work, he says.
Perhaps it is my imagination, my dislike for the man, but I feel he emphasizes the word in a way that suggests only an unrefined woman would deign to perform physical labor.
Do tell Ephraim that I'm looking for him.
I hope he might leave then, but his departure is interrupted by Cyrus. My son rounds the bend in the path, coming from the barn, with a fishing rod over one shoulder and a string of blueback trout in his hand. As always, he is grinning, nearly bursting with good cheer. Yet if I had a knife in my hand at this very moment, I would joyfully drive it through North's throat for the look of disgust that flashes across his face as he watches my son approach. Cyrus Ballard is 33 years old, and he will never marry or have children of his own. He will never work away from the mill or go to sea, though it is his greatest desire. He will never explore the vast wilds of this untamed continent. Cyrus is 33 years old, and he is mute. He was robbed of speech at the age of 12, and the loss has marked his life in irreparable ways. There is no flaw in his intellect or physical ability. He is tall and strong and handsome. He can read and write, and can communicate with his hands when necessary. It is a form of speech we have adopted. Motions instead of words. But outside of our family, he is often pitied, thought dim-witted. An illiterate population cares little for a man with beautiful handwriting, and without speech, he cannot make them understand.
Hello, Cyrus, North says.
He glances back and forth between us, then grins.
Has your father returned from his surveying trip?
Cyrus crosses his arms over his chest and glowers. He doesn't like North any more than the rest of us. After a moment, he moves to stand beside me, protective. Why don't you take the fish inside, I tell him. They'll want cleaning. He nods toward the string, where a cut runs down the belly of each fish to prove he's done it already.
There is some talk about you in the village, North says.
Cyrus's hazel eyes pinch in suspicion. He is unable to take the bait to ask what this talk might be.
Apparently, you got into a fight with Joshua Burgess the night he died. That is fascinating timing, don't you think?
What are you implying? I ask.
Only that your son thrashes a man in front of 50 people, and several hours later, that man turns up dead. I find it curious. Perhaps that officer from the court will too. I hear he's been sniffing around.
Should that happen, you will no doubt refer him to your own judgment of accidental drowning.
A judgment made without benefit of all the facts.
Joseph North smiles.
I cannot help but wonder. If you knew of the fight when you testified before me, Mistress Ballard.
I owe this man nothing. Not answers, not explanations, not respect. And I give him none of it as I stand there waiting for him to leave. But he isn't done.
I want to know what Rebecca Foster told you. If I am to defend myself, I must understand the charges.
The charges seem simple enough to me. A small muscle twitches along his jaw.
The details are vital to my defense.
Your defense is not my concern, Colonel. I am going to Vassalboro to testify on Rebecca's behalf, not yours.
I am judge of this county. By law, you cannot keep that information from me.
It is my duty before the law to give my testimony to the court. As you well know, you will hear it, along with everyone else, next week, before the judge in Vassalboro.
Perhaps.
He might as well have said, if your husband is present, if your husband is still alive, if. But perception means a great deal to Joseph North, and he cannot break character in his role as the wrongfully accused. Perhaps. A more civilized, urbane, less threatening word. Still, there are oceans of meaning in those two syllables. No need to be concerned, Colonel. I am confident the hearing will proceed as planned. He strides back to his mare, gathers the reins. I watch him swing onto his horse, then turn her in a small circle.
You might consider all the ways your confidence is misplaced, he says.
As if on cue, Cicero growls. If I were you, I'd feed that thing before he bites someone.
No point feeding a dog when it can take its own dinner by the throat, he says,
then drives his boots into the mare's sides. Joseph North canters down the drive, mongrel dog at his heels. Friday, December 18. Cloudy and some snow. Colonel North was here. He examined me regarding what conversation Mrs. Foster had with me concerning his conduct toward her last August. I have been at home. Saturday, December 19. Clear part of the day. Today is 35 years since my marriage. Mr. Ballard has not returned from his surveying. I have been at home. Sunday, December 20. Killing chickens is a bloody, awful mess. The task usually falls to Ephraim or Jonathan, but both are gone. So today, Cyrus and I have undertaken the job of butchering, and we usher three ornery cocks to the yard. These are the last of our extra roosters from the spring. Mean things that torment us with beak and spur every time we go to collect the eggs. They are small and spindly, and I'm tired of them. It's no great sadness to see them put in the oven to roast. I hate the axe, I tell Cyrus. We should use revenge. He gives me a questioning glance. Your father's blade, down at the mill. That awful hooked thing, revenge. That's what we call it. Fetch it if you would. It takes him only a few moments to go there and back, but the blade is in his hand when he returns. We silently debate which of us will do the job. He points at me, holds his fist as though he's grasping something, and I agree because there is no good way out of this work. I'll face spurs or blade one way or the other. Better to be in control of the thing that cuts. Cyrus grabs the first bird. He holds it upside down for several moments, letting the blood rush to its head. When its eyes close and its wings stop flapping, I know the cock has fallen asleep. Cyrus holds its head in his other hand and secures his grip on the feet. I hate killing things, but I hate these roosters more, and this is the most humane way to dispatch them. So I cut the fowl's throat with a quick C-shaped motion, and it's done. Cyrus hangs the bird by its feet at the fence so that the blood will drain. It goes quickly enough after that, one after the other. Once we're done, he goes to clean the blade and put it back at the mill. I will have Hannah and Dolly dress and cook the birds once they're plucked. There's no clean way to finish the job, but it's better done outside than in the kitchen, where the feathers and blood will get everywhere. I scald the birds in hot water to loosen the feathers, and then I set up my stool and carving stump in the yard and get to work. Soon there is a pile of black and white feathers in the bucket at my feet. I have gutted the last rooster when once more the sound of horse hooves echoes down the lane. But there are two sets this time, and I do not even bother to get my hopes up. When I lift my head, I see that North is back, and he's brought his wife with him. Halfway down the drive, he holds out his hand and motions to Lydia.
"Wait here,"
he tells her, then kicks his mare into a trot. Lydia North does as she is told and pulls her small gray horse to a stop. She's covered in a green riding cloak, and all I can see is her pale face peeking out beneath the hood. She looks unwell, and her hands are tucked into a muff to stay warm. "Damn it," I think, but go to meet North at the gate, hands sticky with blood.
"Colonel?"
He's dressed in riding clothes and packed for a journey, headed to Vassalboro early, no doubt. The cur is at his heels, eyeing me in that ravenous, predatory way.
"Ephraim?"
he asks, not bothering to dismount or offer a greeting. "On his way." He snorts, unconvinced.
"I would give you one piece of advice. When you stand before the judges,"
North says, voice just low enough that his wife cannot hear, his arm sweeping wide to indicate the house, the barn, the mill.
"Remember who I am. After all, your family depends a great deal upon my generosity."
"Are you threatening me?"
"I am reminding you," he says, "that as an agent of the Kennebec proprietors, it is my duty to confirm that you have met all the conditions required to obtain the deed on this property."
"Don't worry. I remember exactly who you are," I say. "Rebecca Foster told me." I have been so consumed with the chickens that I didn't realize how miserably cold it is out here. The sun has passed its zenith and is sliding toward the horizon, dragging the last of the day's meager heat with it. And a breeze has come in from the east, whipping shards of ice into the air. It stings my cheeks and makes my eyes water. Joseph North's voice is every bit as cold as the air when he replies,
"Clearly, there is more than one idiot living in this house."
I gasp at the insult. I could scream with fury, but I'm not the one who makes the sudden screeching sound. It comes so quick and so loud that I jump, spin around, see nothing. But then there is a rush of air and the flapping of wings as an enormous bird dives toward us. It does a lazy circle around the house, swoops between me and North, then glides to the garden gate, gripping the wooden board so tightly that its talons gash open the weathered cedar. Cicero yips and growls, but he too sees those lethal talons and keeps his distance. North pulls his horse backward in alarm, but I feel only a wild rush of relief. "Percy," I whisper. There are only 3 falconers in the territory of Maine, and only 1 in Hollowell. Ephraim is the only one who practices mounted falconry. So when I say the bird's name, Joseph North loses all bluster and turns his horse away. "I thought you wanted to speak with my husband," I call after him. "As you can see, he is home now."
"It's getting late," North says, gravel in his throat. "I've no time left to dither."
On horseback, at a brisk walk, it will take 4 hours to reach Vassalboro. There is no chance he and Lydia can make it before nightfall, which means they must find shelter along the way, or ride after dark. "Pity," I say, loud enough that Lydia can hear. "I am certain my husband would love to speak with you about your visits this week."
"Cicero, come,"
North snaps. He neither looks at me nor bids me farewell. The mongrel trots after him, skinny rump wagging with each step. North has met up with his wife, halfway to the tree line, when I see another horse and rider emerge. My heart soars for one brief second until I realize that it is not my husband. Moses Pollard is riding his father's favorite stud and wearing his Sunday best. He has a bouquet of bright red sumac berries in one hand and a silly grin on his face. "Oh, good grief," I whisper. Percy tightens his grip on the garden gate, and I hear the scratch of talon against wood. The jesses dangle from his feet, all 12 inches swaying back and forth as he watches the young man approach. Moses has noticed the bird as well, and he pulls up 10 feet from the gate. His horse prances uneasily. "Did you pass Ephraim on the drive?" I ask.
"No."
Moses dismounts, holding the bouquet awkwardly in one hand as he gathers the reins in the other. He clears his throat, uncertain how to proceed now that he knows Hannah's father is not at home. It is obvious he is not prepared for this possibility. Percy, however, is growing impatient and squawks loudly, bobbing his head. "He's hungry," I explain. For a moment, Moses' eyes grow round with alarm, and I realize he's taken it to mean I might set the bird on him. "Hannah," I call, then tighten my lips to stop from laughing when Moses pales. Oh, how faint grows the heart of man when he plucks it, still beating, from his chest and lays it at the foot of a woman. When my daughter appears in the doorway, I say, "You have company, and please send Cyrus out with one of those roosters. Percy is hungry." Hannah's cheeks bloom with happy color when she sees Moses. She smiles at him. He returns the gesture, and I know that all is lost. There will be a wedding within the year. "Is father home?" she asks, looking at the bird. "I don't know, but I have to get Percy to his mews." Hannah ducks inside and returns a moment later with Cyrus, who is holding a plucked bird by the neck. He smiles and dangles it above the ground. There is a teasing glint in those hazel eyes that suggests he might lob the bird right at Moses just to see what happens. Hannah is his little sister, after all. He can't make it easy for her suitor. Under different circumstances, I might let him toy with Moses. "Toss it in front of the gate," I tell Cyrus, "before he comes at you." The chicken lands with a wet flop exactly where Cyrus intends. I back away when Percy launches off the gate and starts to savage his lunch right there on the path. "Moses, why don't you go inside with Cyrus and Hannah and have some tea? I'll get Percy put away in the mill and will join you shortly."
"Of course, Mistress Ballard," he says,
tying the reins and easing through the gate. He keeps a wide berth, careful not to watch the carnage, then follows the others into the house. He would come calling on an afternoon in which it is impossible to keep any sense of decorum. At least they will have a story to tell their children one day. Carefully, I ease to the side and wash the blood from my hands. I am not ashamed to admit that I wait too long to collect Percy. I am hoping Ephraim will come down the drive at any moment and relieve me of the duty. But he does not come, and there is no sound of hooves anywhere in the woods. It grows quieter and colder by the moment. "I'm going to speak with your master about this," I say, pulling the shawl off my shoulders. It isn't enough protection, I know that, but it's better than nothing. And I wrap it around my left forearm. Percy could crush my arm with one ferocious squeeze of those talons. He could rip through flesh and bone. But surely Ephraim's training isn't for naught. This is what I tell myself as I hold my breath, close my eyes, turn my face away, and extend my left forearm at a right angle from my side. No sooner does it come to a halt than a wall of air and beating wings hits my face. I ease the door to Percy's mews open with my foot. He did not, in fact, wound me. Most likely because I did exactly as I have seen Ephraim do 1,000 times. Once Percy was stable on my arm, I looped the fingers of my right hand between his legs, just above his talons, then lifted him off my arm. After that, it was only a matter of securing the jesses and walking, arm extended, down to the mill. Still no sign of Ephraim. Every minute that passes makes the stone in the pit of my stomach grow heavier. All the terrible fears I have kept at bay for the last 2 weeks crash against one another, growing louder and louder. But I cannot entertain any of them now. I must prepare for my trip to Vassalboro on Tuesday, and I must play hostess to the young man who has come to court my daughter. In hindsight, I tell myself that is why I miss the obvious. There was too much happening at once, but I see it, finally, when I lean forward to put the bird in his muse. Ephraim has tied a message around Percy's leg. I'll meet you at the courthouse. Bring the book.
Vassalboro, Wednesday, December 23. I unfold the note, then refold it as I sit on the bed in my rented attic room at the Silver Street Tavern in Vassalboro. I run my thumbnail along the crease, wearing it thin. Ephraim's handwriting is neat and concise, perfectly spaced letters drawn with a steady hand. I marvel at their beauty, at the exactness of each elegant line and curve. My husband is numbered among those who believe that a man's handwriting is a testament to his character. The hearing starts in less than an hour, but Ephraim still isn't here. I made the trip alone yesterday, choosing not to travel with the Fosters so I could have time and space to think, and arrived at sunset, expecting to find my husband waiting for me. He wasn't. So I skipped dinner and went to bed early, eager for a good night's sleep. My stomach rumbles, but the thought of eating makes me nauseous. I put up my hair, pull on my best dress, lace my boots, and tuck the journal into a leather satchel before leaving the room. I descend all three flights of stairs carefully, minding where I set my feet in the dim stairwell. Instead of eating breakfast, I grab a soft, wrinkled apple from a bowl on one of the tables as I pass through the main hall, then take it to the stables behind the tavern where Brutus is housed. It isn't much lighter in there than in the stairwell, and I am forced to dodge piles of manure on my way to his stall. A quick glance in all directions reveals that there is no sign of Sterling. "Where are you?" I mutter under my breath. Brutus wickers when I appear in front of him and sticks his head over the stall door. I hold out the apple on my palm and he picks it off with his teeth. "Don't bite anyone while I'm gone," I say, then rub his nose fondly. I stand there, eyes closed for a moment longer. The smell of hay and horse and manure grounds me. It is a fortifying scent that reminds me of home. "Yes, I'm dawdling," I tell Brutus. "Sometimes a woman has to do a thing she fears." He stares at me, brown eyes unblinking, unsympathetic. Then he snorts, sending a puff of warm air into my face. "Fine, then. Be an ass." Unlike Hollowell, all court proceedings in Vassalboro take place at the meeting house, a long rectangular one-story building that serves as church, courthouse, and community center. It sits directly across the street from the tavern, and once I step outside, I see that there is already a line of people waiting to get in. As in The Hook, court days always draw a crowd. Not wanting to lose an advantageous seat, I hustle across the muddy road and up the steps onto the boardwalk that connects all the shops and buildings on that side of the street. I slide in behind a group of whispering women and follow them into the meeting house. Half the benches are already filled, and I maneuver as close to the front as I can. Once I've chosen my spot, I tuck the satchel between my feet and wait, because one of the defendants in the Foster case also happens to be a circuit court judge. This hearing has garnered a great deal of attention. That does not mean that it will be first on the docket, or that it will even be heard today. The Court of General Sessions has been known to run for up to 3 days, though I suspect that won't be the case this session, given that Christmas is looming. I can see Joseph North sitting to the left of a long table at the front of the room, where an older man in silk robes and a powdered white wig studies the docket. Because it is the winter meeting, his robe is red. Black is reserved for summer. North does not look pleased to be seated with the other defendants, and they do not speak to one another or anyone else. He sits ramrod straight, cleanly shaved, and wearing his best coat. The room continues to fill, and there is still no sign of Ephraim. But at precisely 9 o'clock, the judge bangs his gavel on the table, and the room falls silent. I crane my neck to look for Rebecca Foster and find her in the back corner, sitting beside her husband. Her eyes are closed, and her face is turned toward the window, as though drawing strength from the meager light that filters through. She looks beautiful and broken. Across the aisle and 5 rows forward is Lydia North. She is wan and deflated, thin as a rail, pale as a ghost, cheekbones sharper, clavicles jutting out above the lace collar of her blue dress. I think her headaches must be worse of late, yet she is not deterred from supporting her husband. "The Court of General Sessions is now open," the clerk announces. "The Honorable Obadiah Wood presiding." Honorable is a term used loosely, in that Wood, a physician, is, like North himself, an untrained justice of the peace, recognized by the state of Massachusetts and the District of Maine, but not a lawyer by trade. He fills a specific gap in the legal system and has a rudimentary understanding of the law at best. Most of these judges rule by common sense, but some by partiality. Because this is only a hearing, there are no lawyers present. There is no jury, and no verdict will be handed down. The court meets simply to ascertain the validity of the accusation and to set formal charges for a future trial, should one be required. Obadiah Wood looks at the docket before him and says, "The court will hear evidence in the case of the Commonwealth versus Henry Jackson. Mr. Jackson, a barber, is accused of malicious injury while shaving Jacob Retton 2 months past." 2 men approach the long table and take turns arguing their case, as the judge asks each of them a series of questions. The entire debate takes less than 10 minutes, and Wood declares that Henry Jackson cut his client with a straight razor by accident, and no charges are filed, despite the fact that Jacob Retton will have a scar along his jaw for the rest of his life. Henry Jackson is ordered to pay a fine of 12 shillings in recompense. And so it goes. He hears 3 cases of petty theft, 2 of slander, 1 divorce petition, 1 estate settlement, a breach of contract, said contract being a handshake, and 5 requests for the collection of debt. He orders a total of 6 fines, all of which are recorded by the clerk. It takes nearly 2 hours to clear these cases, and I am starting to feel stiff and numb from sitting so long. I regret not eating breakfast. I am wondering whether there will be an opportunity to slip out and find a privy to relieve myself. "Next on the docket is the Commonwealth versus Joseph North and Joshua Burgess." I tense as North stands. But then Barnabas Lambert slips from his spot at the edge of the room and approaches the table. He'd been so still that I hadn't seen him. He whispers something to Obadiah Wood, then walks back to his seat. Barnabas does see me, however, and I cannot tell whether his expression is one of irritation or curiosity. I doubt he expected to find me here. If there is time afterward, I will apologize for not warning him about the body. Obadiah Wood turns to the clerk and says, "Please strike Joshua Burgess from the court records. We have been notified that he is deceased. Also note that there may be a future inquiry as to cause of death."
"I beg your pardon, Your Honor,"
North takes a step forward and clears his throat.
"I believe there has been a mistake. Benjamin Page, a physician in Hollowell, declared Joshua Burgess's death an accidental drowning."
I look to North, curious what he's up to. Not 5 days ago, he threatened Cyrus, insinuated that he'd been the one to kill Burgess. And now he's pushing Dr. Page's assessment again. It doesn't make sense. As though sensing my scrutiny, North's eyes flick to mine, tighten, then return to the judge. Oh, it's a threat, I think. To me. He knows I don't want Cyrus's name brought up in court regarding a murder investigation. He's reminding me that he has a card to play.
Mr. Lambert? Wood asks.
Barnabas steps forward once more, but removes his hat this time and lays it against his thigh.
Yes, Your Honor. You went to apprehend Mr. Burgess?
I did, on the orders of this court.
And what did you find?
That he is dead. I saw the body myself as it's being stored until the ground thaws enough for burial.
And did it appear to you that the man had drowned?
Barnabas shakes his head, and two ringlets fall across his brow.
No, Your Honor.
North clears his throat. Again, Your Honor, if I may clarify.
If I want your clarification, I will ask for it. As you were saying, Mr. Lambert.
I have been curious about Barnabas from the moment I saw him scuffling outside Pollard's Tavern with James Wall, and he continues to surprise me now.
When I found the body of Mr. Burgess, I saw that he had countless injuries, so I asked to see the court records regarding his death. I was obliged by one Henry Sewell of Hollowell.
Here he glances at me and offers a nod so faint I barely catch it.
It is true that the official cause of death recorded is that of drowning.
The crowd murmurs quietly, and Barnabas lets them.
But, he says after a moment, the record also shows that there was a second conflicting opinion as to cause of death, also recorded by a medical professional, that of murder, specifically hanging. In my capacity as an officer of the court, it is my opinion, given that Mr. Burgess is one of two men accused of a serious crime, this seems a matter worth looking into. In no small part because,
and here he does look apologetic,
during that same hearing, a man was accused of killing Mr. Burgess.
What man? Wood asks.
Reverend Isaac Foster, sir.
Stupid boy, I think. And when Barnabas glances at me, he can safely judge my thoughts by my expression alone. His eyebrows pinched together in concern before he turns back to Wood.
Mr. North, Wood asks, was any proof of this offered to your court?
He stands, and I can see that he is choosing his words carefully.
A young woman who used to work for the Fosters claims that she overheard Mrs. Foster say that her husband killed the man. But that point was also argued in my courtroom. So I had my clerk record the accusation, but took no further action as it seemed to be a concern best left to another court.
North offers a pinched smile.
Given the circumstances. Well, at least we can agree on that, Wood snorts,
then whacks the table with his gavel.
The clerk will note that the question of Joshua Burgess's cause of death remains undecided and will be held over until the next session, as will any consideration of involvement by Reverend Foster or anyone else. We will move forward to the issue at hand. The case against Joseph North as it relates to the accusation of injury to Mistress Foster's person. All parties, please come forward.
Rebecca moves to the front of the room, fingers knotted together at her waist, head held high. Isaac follows, a hand set protectively in the small of her back. She looks at Isaac, alarmed, when he pulls away from her side and approaches the table.
I have a request to make before we begin, he says.
Wood looks at Rebecca, then at Isaac.
I presume you are Mr. Foster? I am. Have no fear, Mr. Foster. The court will not concern itself today with the accusation made against you. That is not what I would like to address. Although, given that neither my wife nor I were in Judge North's court last month, and we did not have the chance to defend ourselves,
I would like the record to show that I formally deny the accusation. I had no part in that man's death.
Very well, then. The clerk will record your statement.
Isaac Foster is just past 30 and is drifting from plain to homely, yet he still has the voice of an orator and it resonates through the room.
On the same day those scurrilous accusations were made against me, Joseph North filed fornication charges against my wife. I would like them dropped.
That is highly unusual, Wood says. Why were charges filed?
Isaac opens his mouth to answer, but North, clearly nervous, interrupts.
Mistress Foster's young housekeeper brought that charge, not me. She claims that Mistress Foster is pregnant by a man not her husband.
And would this be the same young woman, no longer in her employ, who also accused her husband of murder? Wood asks.
Ah, he clears his throat. Yes, it would.
There is ice in Obadiah Wood's tone as he asks,
and you thought it appropriate to file these charges in a case in which you are the defendant?
The courtroom is hushed. All eyes turn to the front of the room where this latest twist is unfolding. North lifts his chin.
I thought to do my job.
In this case, you overstep. I order that all fornication charges against Rebecca Foster be dropped immediately.
He turns to the clerk.
Cite a conflict of interest as the explanation.
In the Court of General Sessions, the lone judge has great leeway in these matters. The Court of Common Pleas, however, requires a majority ruling, so I am grateful that it is one man and not three hearing this case today.
May I continue? Or are there other breaches of conduct you would like to inform us of?
Obadiah Wood folds his hands on the table and looks squarely at North.
By all means, let's get this over with,
North tells him. I brave a glance at Lydia, who, eyes locked on her husband, seems to be flushed now. But she has the good sense to keep whatever she is feeling to herself and refrains from making any outburst. Wood once again scans the docket, then looks up at the gathered crowd.
The charge states that on the night of August 10th, Joseph North and Joshua Burgess broke into the home of Isaac Foster and injured the wife of said Mr. Foster.
He looks to Rebecca.
Is that the charge you are bringing before this court?
Rebecca stands before the table, and when she speaks, her voice does not waver. No, it is not.
I am not alone in drawing in a hard gasp.
Oh God, what is she doing? I think.
Obadiah Wood looks at his docket and then back up at Rebecca. My notes indicate a physical injury. If not that, what is your charge?
Physical injuries did occur, she says.
And there on the last syllable, I can hear the first break in her voice.
But they were because of a rape. That is my charge, Your Honor. On the night of August 10th, those men broke into my house and...
She clears her throat, swallows hard.
They raped me.
Wood tightens his brow. That is a very serious charge. Do you have any evidence?
They left evidence enough right here. Rebecca sets a trembling hand to her belly and pulls the fabric tight so that the small round protrusion is evident.
Are you also charging that you are with child as a result of this assault?
I am.
After a moment, Wood turns to North. What have you to say to these charges?
All of the bluster is gone from his voice.
I deny everything this woman has said. I was not at her home that evening, and I did not do the things she accuses me of.
Wood.
Then where were you? I had dinner at my home with one Major Henry Warren of the Boston Militia. His regiment is in Fort Halifax now, but he will happily attest to this fact if given the chance. After dinner, he left, and my wife and I went to bed. Mistress North?
Wood asks. She stands, and when she speaks, her voice is small. It is as he says. My husband was at home that evening.
North does not look at Rebecca,
but he does soften his voice.
I do not question whether someone accosted Mistress Foster, but none of what she claims happened by my hand. I have been falsely accused.
A grievous assault may have been perpetrated against your person, Mistress Foster. Wood points a finger in warning at North, who is about to interrupt again.
But I do find myself in the difficult position of being unable to verify your claims. Without a witness to this assault, we cannot prove that it happened. And to charge a man with a capital crime without any evidence is a difficult thing.
Isaac Foster begins to tremble. It starts in his voice and moves to his outstretched arm, pointing at North. It is the least composed that I have ever seen him. He is angry, sweating. His spectacles slide down his nose and he shoves them back in place.
He witnessed this. He did it.
Wood looks pained as he reminds Isaac that North is a defendant, not a witness, and that he has denied the accusations regardless.
Please, Rebecca steps closer to the judge. I do have a witness. She is in this courtroom. She can testify that I speak the truth.
I feel my stomach twist with a sudden rush of adrenaline, and my heart takes flight within my chest, beating hard against my ribs.
I protest this witness, North says, stepping forward again. She does not.
Obadiah Wood's voice is loud, clipped on the syllables. He is losing patience.
It is not your turn to speak, Mr. North. You will have your chance. Step back.
North does as he's told, but I can see the growing bubble of frustration in his chest, the way it puffs in and out with each breath. He is accustomed to having total control of a courtroom.
Who is this witness?
Wood asks. Me, I say, standing. The entire room swings their heads in my direction. I can verify everything that Rebecca Foster has just told the court.
Please, step forward, Mistress
Ballard. Judge Wood waves his arm, indicating that I should approach the table.
I object,
Joseph North says, abandoning all sense of propriety.
The law of coverture prevents any woman, even one as esteemed as Mistress Ballard, from testifying in court without the presence of her father or husband.
And what concern is this of yours, Colonel?
Great concern, every word of it. The law remains firm on the parameters of what testimony she can give.
I weave my way through the crowd, satchel in hand, ignoring North, and speak directly to Wood. I am a midwife, and the laws of Massachusetts and the District of Maine allow me to give testimony in court apart from any covering, whether it be husband or father. I do so in Joseph North's courtroom several times a year, and he has never once objected. North shakes his head, lifts a hand, finger pointed for emphasis, and comes to stand before the table himself.
The laws of Massachusetts state that a midwife may give testimony in matters of paternity. It gives her no such allowance in legal hearings such as this.
One could argue that this is a matter of paternity, I say.
That is an accusation that can never be proved.
For the first time today, Obadiah Wood appears uncertain. He looks at North, then back to me, but he does not speak or offer comment on North's objection. The longer the silence continues, the straighter North stands. I tighten my grip on the satchel. Please, Your Honor, my father died many years ago, and my husband
is here.
Ephraim shouts from the back of the courtroom, right by the door.
I am here.
It takes Ephraim a moment to reach the front. The meeting house is so full, there is standing room only at this point, that he must squeeze between dozens of spectators to reach my side. When he does, he smells of horse, sweat, and wind, and I know that he has ridden hard to be here in time. He gives my hand one comforting squeeze.
"I'm so sorry,"
he whispers in my ear.
"I will explain later."
Ephraim turns to the judge and smiles. He knows Obadiah Wood, but he announces himself for the benefit of those watching.
"I am Ephraim Ballard, Martha's husband, and I apologize for the delay."
He levels an unforgiving glare at North.
"I was unavoidably detained."
"Thank you for coming, Mr. Ballard,"
Wood says, then motions to me.
"Please tell the court what you know of the events that happened on August 10th.
I called on Mistress Foster on the 19th of August and found her badly injured. I am a midwife. I have been attending women for over 30 years. I know the damage done by rape, and Rebecca's injuries were some of the worst I have ever seen."
"She is lying,"
North growls.
"Is that your only defense?" Wood snaps at him. "That any woman who contradicts you is a liar?"
"Continue, Mistress Ballard."
"The injuries from her assault were witnessed with my own eyes. She had multiple bruises and cuts, a split lip. I dressed her wounds and helped her bathe and listened to the details of what happened to her. She hasn't changed a word from that day to this."
Obadiah Wood scratches at his jaw.
"How can the court be certain that you and Mistress Foster have not conspired to wrongly accuse Colonel North?" I swallow a sigh.
I will never understand why men think that women work so hard to destroy them. In my experience, it is usually the opposite. "I can prove it," I tell him, "if you will allow me."
"By all means."
I pull the diary from my satchel, take it to the table, then set it before the judge and turn back to the entry on August 19th. I scoot the book closer for him to read. "There," I say. "I recorded Rebecca's accusation in my daybook on the night she told me. You will note that I've made many months' worth of entries since, and that I could not have gone backward to fill it in. What Rebecca claims is true, in every word and detail." Obadiah Wood dismisses us, so he can read the diary entries and deliberate. Based on how many people trickle out of the meeting house, it feels as though the entire town of Vassalboro is present. As Ephraim and I make our way to the door, I see Lydia North out of the corner of my eye. She is waving, trying to get my attention as she angles through the crowd. Once she gets within a few feet of us, Lydia calls out,
"Martha, can we speak? I am out of tonic."
But by then we have reached the crush of people surging out the door, and Lydia is shifted away, her voice lost in the buzzing crowd. I don't look to Ephraim to see if he noticed her, for right now it is easier to pretend I didn't hear. Once outside, I walk with Ephraim as he leads Sterling to the stables to be fed and groomed.
"You got my message?"
he asks, searching for an empty stall. "I nearly lost an arm in the process, but yes."
"Percy wouldn't hurt you."
"I'm glad you're certain of that. I had to feed him a plucked chicken just to make sure." Once Ephraim has handed the reins to the gap-toothed stable boy and given him a shilling to tend the horse, I throw my arms around him. "I was so worried you wouldn't make it."
"I almost didn't."
He pulls me closer, breathes in the scent of my skin.
"The bog is wretched this time of year. We were nearly swallowed twice. If North assigns that lease, I'll call him a murderer. No one could survive there."
"Well, he certainly wanted to murder you just now," I say.
"Let him try."
"I would rather that he not, if you don't mind. I've lived without you long enough these last weeks." Ephraim leads me back to the tavern, and we eat an uneasy lunch at a small corner table. The stew is flavorless and the bread dry. I long for our town and our tavern and the cooking of Abigail Pollard. We pick at our food until a man comes to stand beside me and clears his throat. I look up into an apologetic face.
"Mistress Ballard,"
he says, then nods to Ephraim.
"Mr. Ballard."
"This is Barnabas Lambert," I explain to my husband, "officer of the court. Much has happened while you were away. Ephraim watches the boy, but says nothing. Barnabas takes off his hat.
I did not know the Fosters were your friends,
he tells me. You couldn't have.
I certainly didn't intend to make their situation worse. I can see that I have, though, and that troubles me. I only reported what I found in Hollowell.
He clears his throat, and the accusation is gentle.
What you sent me to find.
I do not look at my husband, though I can feel his curious gaze on my profile. The fault is mine. I should have told you that Burgess was dead. But I was afraid you would leave without investigating. I stand by my assessment that he was murdered, but it was not by Isaac Foster.
You know this for certain?
I hesitate, but only for a moment. Though I am old enough to be certain of little, I do know that Isaac is a bookish man, not a brutish one. And it was he who insisted that this case go through the courts. It makes no sense that he would take justice into his own hands before the process even got started.
Well, I hope you are right.
He returns the hat to his head.
I'd best be getting back.
Ephraim watches him go, and I can see all the questions building in his eyes. Once Barnabas has pushed through the door, he turns to me.
What was all that about?
I think young Mr. Lambert is trying to remain on my good side.
And why exactly would he be concerned with that?
Probably because he's smitten with your daughter.
I doubt Moses will be pleased to hear that.
I doubt Moses will care. Barnabas isn't after Hannah. Ephraim does the math, frowns.
No, she's too young.
Explain that to Dolly.
I'd rather you explain what's happened while I've been gone, and quickly.
I open my mouth to do just that, when we hear the sound of shouting in the streets. The judge is ready. The spectators make room for Ephraim and me as we enter the meeting house again. We find better seats toward the front this time. Wood waits until those involved are present.
The case brought before the court today is difficult.
Obadiah Wood begins.
Mistress Foster gave compelling testimony, and Mistress Ballard gave proof that she was accosted in August, as she says.
Oh God, no, I think. I can feel it coming, the but that will serve as justification for denying justice. I can feel it coming the way I sense a storm or an argument. Like lightning in the air, it rises in my blood and I squeeze Ephraim's hand so hard that he hisses in protest.
The difficulty is, Wood continues, that the Court of General Sessions was established to settle petty matters, and there is nothing petty about the charges we heard today. I am thus referring this case to the Court of Common Pleas for additional advice.
The room erupts, but Wood bangs his gavel 7 times.
The court will reconvene in Hollowell with a full bench on January 29th.
What a coward! What a guttersnipe! What a foul, stinking codpiece! I slam the door to my room at the tavern after Ephraim steps inside. I throw my satchel to the floor, pace. He just absolved himself of responsibility. Ephraim lowers himself to the bed with a tired groan and pulls off his boots.
He sits on the Court of Common Pleas for Kennebec County. That means he'll be hearing the case again.
He could have brought charges today. He could have sent it straight to the Supreme Judicial Court. Ephraim's voice is warm and soft.
The man was being shrewd, Martha. He knows that any serious charges brought by a lower court would likely be tossed out unless they go through the Court of Common Pleas first. But a majority verdict from the sessions will be heard. What seems like cowardice might in fact be the only hope Rebecca has.
I can feel the anger rolling toward me like a fog, and I begin to tremble. My eyes burn. Ephraim Ballard has long made a study of me. He can feel my moods shift like the wind. He pulls me down to sit beside him, so that I can lay my head on his shoulder. It isn't fair.
No, it isn't.
And then I cry.
mostly for Rebecca and the tiny unwanted beating heart deep within her womb, but also for myself and our daughters and for every other woman who lives, suffers, and dies by the mercurial whims of men. 3 minutes later, when I have wrung myself dry, I lean over and pull the journal out of my satchel.
What are you doing?
The only thing I can. I take up my pen and, with a trembling hand, mix my ink. My rage makes my handwriting almost illegible. Wednesday, December 23. A cloudy day. I went to Vassalboro as evidence in the cause between the Commonwealth and Joseph North, Esquire. The charge was that North, on the night of August 10th, broke into the house of Isaac Foster and ravished his wife. My testimony was that Mrs. Foster, on the 19th of August, complained to me that she had received great abuses from North and was gravely injured. The judge determined the cause is to be laid before the sessions next January. When I bring dinner to the room several hours later, Ephraim laughs at me.
What?
He nods toward the jug of cider on the wood tray and the two mugs beside it.
Didn't they have any ale? You know I don't drink that stuff.
I look at the jug, and it takes a moment to remember what he's talking about. That was a long time ago, and besides, my father was upset.
He tried to kill me.
Maim, possibly paralyze, but I don't think he wanted you dead, or at least not permanently. Ephraim rolls his eyes.
I don't think a temporary death is what he had in mind when he threw the jug at my head.
The laugh surprises me. It is good medicine after weeks of angst. After such a disappointing day, perhaps he did want to kill you. Just a little. But I think we can both agree you deserved it.